Welcome to the Federal Society's Practice Group podcast. The following podcast, hosted by the Federal Society's Litigation Practice Group, was recorded on Wednesday, August 9th, 2017, during a live teleforum conference call held exclusively for Federal Society members.
Welcome to the Federalist Society's teleforum conference call. This afternoon, we will discuss the American Law Institute's evolving position on civil liability reform. My name is Wesley Hodges, and I am the Associate Director of Practice Groups at the Federalist Society. As always, please note that all expressions of opinion are those of the expert on today's call. Today, we are happy to have with us Victor E. Schwartz, who is a partner at Shook, Hardy & Bacon, LLP, where he is chair of their public policy group. He has been a member of ALI since he was a child and is an author of a leading casebook on tort law. After Victor's opening remarks, we'll move to an audience Q&A. Thank you for speaking with us, Victor. The floor is now yours.
Thank you very much. Today we're going to talk about one of the most powerful, I would say, legal organization in the United States. And very few people know anything about it. It's called the American Law Institute. People know about the American Bar Association and other legal groups, but the American Law Institute was founded 94 years ago, and it was founded by very prominent people, including former President William Howard Taft, a great Justice Cardozo. And it was formed because the law, the common law, had become very diverse. One state may have called a battery one thing, and another state called it something else. And the purpose was to provide some clarification and consistency in American law. And how do they do this? They did it through work products that they created. And the most important, which I'm going to discuss a bit, is restatements of law. Restatements basically are an attempt to put in a black letter statement what might be pages and pages of writings in judicial opinions. For example, the simplest of torts is a battery. And the restatement traditionally defined battery as a harmful or offensive contact. So it's not just if you hit somebody, but also if you in some way make an offensive contact. You pull a plate away from somebody because you don't like his race and it's a waiter. Restatements, at least in the beginning, and this is where the controversy starts, had to be supported by existing law, by decisions by judges in state courts. It didn't have to be always the majority rule. It could be the 10 states did one thing and two states did another, and the two states' law was selected for restatements. But there had to be some existing law. And the problem we have, and I'll get into it a little bit more, is some restatements now may not reflect the law in any state. Just to give you a little bit of an idea of the power of restatements, last year, American Law Institute restatements were cited 2,005 times by state or federal courts. And that's amazing when you think of that number. The Supreme Court of the United States, in its opinions, if we include dissents and majority rules, cited restatements 9 times. The year before, it was 11. The power cannot be overstated. Restatements are important to lots of people, but especially in recent times to the business community. Traditionally, restatements have focused on areas that are in first-year law school, torts, which is liability rules, property, contracts, but new topics have gotten have gotten into. And one of the newer topics is a restatement of the law of liability insurance. This is an attempt to deal with a complex of rules that directly affect the insurance industry. And the work product, and I'll get into it a little bit more, is thought by many in the industry, in a number of cases, not to reflect existing law. But the views of the reporters, who are two very distinguished professors, their own views. This has also been true, and I'll develop this a little bit more, with a relatively new draft. These things are still being worked on. What is called the Restatement of the Law of Consumer Contracts. Now, in its 94 years, the American Law Institute has never produced a separate restatement labeled consumer. They have the law of contracts going back 94 years, not consumer contracts. There's no restatement of consumer torts. There's no restatement of consumer property. But this project, which I'll discuss in more detail, has gone off on a direction that has no precedent whatsoever. Apart from restatements, the American Law Institute develops what are called principles projects. Principles projects deal with complex areas of law that need clarification and organization, but they do not have to be based on existing case law. The people who write principles projects have the latitude to use their own views and provide their own views. As you'd expect, those of you who are listening, principles projects do not have the worship by courts that restatements do. They can influence legislatures. They can influence public policymakers. Two important principles projects over the past several decades are the law of corporate governance and the law of aggregate litigation. That's mass actions and class actions. Currently, the most important principles project is called Principles of Data Privacy. Its purpose is to guide the development of data privacy by establishing so-called best practice guidelines. And at least in my view, and when they said I was a member since a child, that was half funny, but I've been a member of the American Law Institute for 45 years, and I think this is going to be one of their most powerful and influential principles projects that ever been, because there's no one else who's trying to organize the principles of data privacy in the United States anyway, the way the American Law Institute is developing it. And this project is unlikely to be completed, I think, until 2020 or so. So it's still in flux. And this is an interesting question. Right now, it's a little uncertain as to whether this project strictly is best practice guidelines or rules that, if broken, could create new ways to sue. If there are any plaintiff's lawyers online, there may not be. This could be a wonderful new addition to your bank account, because new ways to sue would be put forth by the American Law Institute. Again, not as powerful as restatements, but because the area is so inchoate, it could be very influential. So the American Law Institute makes restatements. They make principles projects, and they make one final work product. And these are model codes. These are model pieces of legislation. Then where the ALI works with the National Commissioners on Uniform State Laws and comes up with model laws that may be adopted by states. The most famous, at least I think, in the history of the American Law Institute is the Model Penal Code. That goes way back to 1972, but it's the basis for the criminal law in the overwhelming majority of states. 1962 is a long time ago, and currently the ALI is revising the sentencing portion and the sexual assault portion of the Model Penal Code. Well, how are these work products made? How are restatements made? They're not made in a factory. The way they're made is the leadership of the ALI, who are the executive director, currently Ricky Revesz, a former dean of NYU, and a deputy director, currently Stephanie Middleton, a highly experienced corporate lawyer. They suggest topics. Some of the membership tells them what topics might be considered, but the leadership makes the decision. We're going to restate the law of liability insurance. And then they appoint reporters who draft the projects. The reporters are always law professors. Now, I was a law professor for a number of years, and it's a great profession, and there's a lot of smart people in there. But a lot of law professors have never practiced law in their lives. They've never advised a client. They've never been in court, well, maybe for their divorce. But otherwise, they haven't been there. And so that kind of tends to set a direction in which some of these restatements travel. Now, the reporters do not act alone. They have an advisory committee that is also appointed by the leadership. You can't lobby your way onto an advisory committee. They try to balance them between plaintiff lawyers, defense lawyers, professors, judges, and they often are pretty balanced. But the reporters do not have to listen to the advisory committee, and often they don't. There is also a new body that any member of the ALI, American Law Institute, can be part of what is called the Members Consultative Committees. Anybody can join that. And that's grown more influential in the past 10 years. Drafts written by the reporters are reviewed by advisors and the members' consultative groups, and suggestions are made. Again, they may be taken and maybe not. The reporters then send them to the American Law Institute Council. Now, these are the real top kind of members of the ALI, and there's about 50 members of the council. They are often judges, sitting judges, law professors, and prominent practitioners. The council can review the drafts, and they can modify the drafts. They can do something advisors can't do. And once in a while, they do it. Once a council approves a draft, the draft goes before the entire ALI membership at annual meetings. If you're going to vote on this, you have to go to the annual meeting. And portions are approved or not approved by the membership. At least in my experience, most of the time, the membership approves what the reporters have done. There is debate on every little section of the restatement, but the reporters usually prevail. Now, with that background, what problems are there? And I also should mention that right now there's restatements of the law of what's called conflicts of law. It's a complex area, but that deals with when courts have a case that have contacts in more than one state, whose law is chosen. It can be very important in some cases. And there is a restatement currently being developed of the law of copyright. That is very unusual because copyright is statutory, but the copyright laws are so old that they've been construed by courts, and this restatement is supposed to select from constructions by courts of what the best law is. I'm going to focus on three current projects that I've mentioned: the restatement of the law of liability insurance, the restatement of the law of consumer contracts, and the restatement of intentional torts, because all of them have problems. In the restatement of the law of liability insurance, which was supposed to be voted on this year, but was postponed because of the controversy surrounding this. There are some proposals that are very, very controversial. The overwhelming majority of courts, almost every court, in interpreting an insurance contract follows what's called the plain meaning rule. What's that mean? It means what it says. If there's a plain meaning to a word or a sentence, that's what's followed. We don't take other evidence to construe plain meaning. But this draft restatement does just that. It allows extrinsic evidence, forgive me for using the word, but that's the legal word, words other than the plain meaning, to construe it. So if a contract says the insurer is responsible for doing X or Y, notifying in 30 days, all of a sudden you could have evidence apart from what the plain meaning is introduced. At least in my view, that leads to a lot of litigation and goes against common sense. I'll just mention one other provision in this restatement. Probably anyone on the line who is a lawyer knows the American rule on attorney fees. Each party pays its own attorney. That's it. But in this restatement of the law of liability insurance, there's a number of provisions that have attorney fee shifting. But it's one way. Now think about this. Listen to this. If the insurer loses the case, it has to pay the other side's legal fees. But if it wins the case, it still has to pay its own fees. This is one-way fee shifting. Very controversial. Not following the rule in an overwhelming majority states and setting a precedent that could be very dangerous for the business community. There is also, I mentioned, the restatement of the law of consumer contracts. This one, in the view of some, is really off the wall. There is no law of consumer contracts. You can go on Google and try to find it. It doesn't exist. But what the project does is try to protect consumers from what they think may be unreasonable and unfair actions by businesses. Instead of citing cases, which they do once in a while, the reporters who wrote this cite what are called consumer protection laws. Those are statutes. This project is still underway, and for any business that uses a consumer contract, watch out, because there's new ways that this restatement would allow a person who signs a contract, reads what's in it, to nullify that contract. And I'll mention one other one with respect to the restatement of the law of intentional torts. In my casebook and some of the others, the most simple case that's talked about right in the beginning is a battery. For almost 300 years, a battery is a harmful or offensive contact. But offensive has been what's offensive to a reasonable person. To a reasonable person. Not a super sensitive plaintiff. Someone who would object to being touched by a feather, for example. Give you something you can remember. In this draft restatement, if a person knows that something might be offensive to a super sensitive plaintiff and touches them, for example, with a feather, that can constitute a battery. Think about that. There's a lot of super sensitivity going on in the world. And if somebody simply states that this is a super sensitive contract, you could end up with a battery. Think about that in the workplace. So I'm going to stop there and take questions that people may have or clarify matters that I have stated. And thank you for your patience in listening.
Thank you, Victor. Let's go ahead and move to audience Q&A. In a moment, you'll hear the prompt indicating that the floor mode has been turned on. After that, to request the floor, please enter the star key and then the pound key on your keypad. Again, to ask a question, enter the star key and then the pound key. When we get to your request, You will hear a prompt, and then you may ask your question. We will answer questions in the order in which they are received. As we wait for audience questions, just to get us started, Victor, what do you believe is the most important issue facing the American Law Institute today?
The most important issue facing the American Law Institute today is whether restatements are going to follow the traditional path and be based at least on some existing case law written by sitting judges, or whether restatements will be now deemed aspirational things, things that reporters believe in. Justice Scalia, in a concurring opinion written a year before he passed away, said that some modern restatements just reflect the views, and I'm paraphrasing, of law professors, and at least in his view, they should be given no more credibility than a law review article written by an individual professor. In the next 10 years, judges will decide whether the Justice Scalia concern has become so permeating restatements that that's the amount of respect they should have. And if that happens, at least in my judgment, there won't be 2,700 citations of restatements. The issue is not resolved. And at the last meeting of the ALI, when membership approved a redefinition of the law of battery, there wasn't one solid case that supported them. So that's the issue. Is it going to be aspirational views of reporters, or are restatements to reflect existing law in at least some jurisdictions?
To ask a question, remember, please enter the star key and then the pound key. Let's go ahead and move to our first audience question.
Victor, this is Jack Park. Thanks for your report. Some years ago, after a restatement or a restatement of principles on property law came out, there was an article about how there were changes that were favorable to the plaintiff's bar. And there was consideration in some states to statements that didn't apply, or alternatively restatement of the state's laws. To what extent should states consider protecting themselves from the use of ALI in their courts?
Well, that's a very good question about to what extent should states, and I would suggest that state legislatures protect the people of the state from restatements that are aspirational in nature. The one example we have of that, and it's an interesting example to me, because I was, as a member, I thought this provision was not a good idea. In the restatement of torts third, there was a provision that said that trespassers are people who come on your land, they have not been invited, they shouldn't be there, trespassers, that there would be a duty of reasonable care to trespassers, except for what the restatement called flagrant trespassers. Maybe that's somebody who committed a murder. But the restatement didn't define it. The American Tort Reform Association and its president, Tiger Joyce, undertook a campaign to prevent courts from adopting that provision of the restatement. And they had a model law, which was approved by the American Legislative Exchange Council, that addressed that issue. And the model law was actually enacted by approximately 23 states. That's the only time, to the best of my knowledge, in the history of the American Law Institute that a restatement was blocked by legislatures. I mean, the cost, if you're in a state with a lot of farmland or to railroads where people go on tracks, the cost of that potential restatement could have been in the millions of dollars. So they had a model law that simply froze the existing law of a state on trespassers. It didn't change the law, but it said, okay, in Texas, trespassers are only owed a duty to refrain from willful and wanton conduct, and that's the traditional rule. So it was quite a successful venture by the American Tort Reform Association. And I would think, I don't know, that if I were, well, if I were in the leadership of the ALI and saw that, I think I would be a little bit cautious about going off and having black letter rules be aspirational. But that was a pretty successful effort. One state, Nevada, had adopted that restatement. I mean, I once made this analogy about some judges and restatements. I have a dog named Kylie the dog. She is a yellow lab. If I hold a biscuit up, she eats it. She doesn't look at what's in it. She just chomps it. And there are judges who treat restatements just like that. And that's what Nevada did. And the legislature overruled what they did in creating a duty of reasonable care to trespassers. Can you imagine people breaking into casinos when they're closed, going on ranches in Nevada where they're not permitted? So it's a long answer, but it was a very, very important question. Yes, state legislatures can prevent portions of restatements that are not restatements from being adopted by courts. And they have done that in that one instance, the only time in 94 years.
Thank you, Victor.
Thank you for your question. Let's move to our next caller.
Hi, Victor. It's Marcia Rabiteau. Thank you for a most informative presentation. It's really important to get the word out, for sure, about all of this, and thank you for doing that. But in addition to that action item, what more can be done? And I'm specifically concerned about judges who really are unaware about these changes in the ALI and making them aware of the fact that perhaps they shouldn't be depending on the restatements the way they have in the past to make their rulings.
A good question, and thank you, Marcia. As terms of how can judges be informed, and not simply adopt restatements that are aspirational views, as the Supreme Court of Nevada did, and I don't fault them because they were just thinking in traditional lines. One, there are judicial education programs in the United States, good ones, such as the one at George Mason. I think it's now called the Scalia Law School, it is, but it's still the George Mason Judicial Education Project, where information can be given to judges about parts of restatements that don't reflect existing law, and also have debates. I would invite reporters who have sponsored black letter laws that don't have any foundation, so the judges see and hear it. Judges do look at law reviews, and there's some law reviews that they look at with particular care. There's a law review called the Journal of Trial Advocacy, where the principal subscribers are judges. So that's another vehicle to alert judges to the problems with some parts of the restatement. And there have been editorials. Tiger Joyce of ATRA had an op-ed in the Wall Street Journal about a month ago expressing concerns about certain parts of the restatement. So those are three vehicles that people can use, and you may have other ideas to reach judges, and I'd welcome your thoughts.
Well, I think one of the things that we probably also ought to be thinking about is doing more education of defense practitioners and helping them understand how to circumvent the restatement issues that they're undoubtedly going to encounter.
I think that's a very good idea. You have the DRI and the I'm trying to remember the international.
The International Association of Defense Counsel.
Right, and those are good vehicles because the plaintiffs. I don't. Somebody wrote that maybe there's some control of the ALI by plaintiffs' lawyers. I don't really see that. There's more plaintiffs' lawyers there, but certainly if they're handed a gift, they're going to use the gift. And they're going to cite it as if it's a holy writ, and it may not be. And to the extent defense lawyers can learn a little bit more about how to oppose that, that's good. Going beyond Marcia's question, but when you look at these restatements, there are three parts to it. There's the black letter rule, that's that simple black letter. A battery is a harmful or offensive contact. And that's now longer because of protection given to supersensitive plaintiffs. Then there's comments, which some states adopt readily, other states say are not part of the restatement. And then there's a part that's often ignored. And to the extent that defense lawyers want to oppose restatements, they should look at this part that is ignored. And that's the reporter's notes, because that's the buttress of the bridge, the black letter. And if that buttress is weak and you look at the reporter's notes and you see that there really is no case law of support, that, at least in my view, is the way to attack a restatement provision that is not sound. But not a lot of people know about that because they haven't sat down with them in their lap and read them. One other thing in terms of correcting things is for people to join the ALI. It isn't easy. There's 3,000 members, and it is extremely difficult to get into the ALI. But it can be done. Recently, two very fine corporate lawyers have been made members, Dan Troy, who is the general counsel of GSK, Carla Van Dongen, who's a prominent lawyer with State Farm. In general, over the past 20 years, corporate lawyers have not expressed an interest in joining. So to the extent that they can and get in, that helps too, because you have people who are very knowledgeable about topics and can participate in the making of these restatements.
Thank you for your question. The queue is currently open. If anyone would like to ask another question, please press the star key and then the pound key.
Oh, I want to just quickly mention the name of that act. Yeah, we named it the Trespasser Responsibility Act, just in case anyone who wants to look it up. That was enacted in about 23 states.
As we wait for our next question, I'd like to inform everyone that our next telephone conference call is scheduled for tomorrow, Thursday, August 10th, at noon. That call will be hosted by the Regulatory Transparency Project, discussing bureaucracy in America. Just a reminder, please keep an eye out for emails announcing these teleforum calls. You can also consult the full schedule of upcoming teleforum calls on our website, fedsoc.org. Also on our website is a page that lists all of the previously recorded teleforums as podcasts, where you can listen to them or download them at your leisure. Seeing as there are no more audience questions at this time, Victor, would you like to give any closing remarks?
Very briefly, the ALI has a website, www.ali.org. I would suggest that those who are interested in what the ALI is up to visit that website. It is open to non-members, not everything, but enough to alert you to what's going on, and that this is an area where change can be made, but it requires people to be a bit more active and a bit more knowledgeable about what the American Law Institute does. The American Law Institute members are judges, law professors, lawyers. It is a very fine and prestigious organization, and it's unfortunate if it goes off in directions that diminish the respect that it has earned over the past 94 years. And you've done a service here at the Federalist Society. I value your allowing me to discuss this so that more people will become familiar with something that is much more powerful than things that other people give attention to. The American Law Institute is extremely influential on the creation of American law. And the more sunlight that's put on it, the more likely it will continue to have a position of being a highly responsible organization. So thank you.
Thank you, Victor. On behalf of the Federalist Society, I'd like to thank you for the benefit of your valuable time and expertise today. We welcome all listener feedback by email at info@fedsoc.org. Thank you all for joining us. This call is now adjourned.
Thank you.
Thank you for listening. We hope you enjoyed this Practice Group podcast. For materials related to this podcast and other Federalist Society multimedia, please visit the Federalist Society's website at fedsoc.org/multimedia.